Okay, this will be better. All right, so these kinds of experiments on photosynthesis started out a long time ago. This is something from more than 100 years ago to give you a basic idea of the scale of this. So this is an experiment done on these, you've all seen this slime in lakes, which is an algae that looks like this. And the experiment was to disperse colored light across the length of this filament and to watch at what points oxygen was evolved. So oxygen is evolved in photosynthesis, so that will tell you what colors of light lead to that. Is it just all the white light spectrum or not? And what was found was that red light and blue light led to oxygen evolution. So the red light is absorbed by chlorophyll, and the blue partly by chlorophyll, partly by carotenoids. But what these first kinds of experiments were showing is that there's an energy gathering involved here. So that it turns out there are proteins that capture the light in specific spectral regions, and they'll funnel that energy to other proteins that actually start the photochemistry. So it's specific of these proteins that I'll be talking about, and it's the proteins involved in gathering and moving the light. And so what these proteins are scaffolds that hold in them light-absorbing molecules. So I've drawn some molecules here. And how to think about the molecules is simply as two-level systems, because that's exactly how they behave. And mostly they're in the ground electronic state, and sometimes after they absorb a photon, like Alice here, she's in an excited state, and there's some interaction between these molecules. And in the simplest case, which is of little interest to you in this audience, there would be a small interaction that would allow that excitation to jump. This is an electronic excitation, so it's a boson overall, would jump, say, to Bob, and that would happen according to normal rate laws. Now, of course, what I'm going to talk to you about is the case when this hopping of the excitation doesn't happen like this, when we can't say that it's completely localized on Alice, and then becomes completely localized on Bob. And what I want to show you is how you can see that in an experiment. Now, in these proteins, we have many, many of those light harvesting molecules, and I want to just start by giving you a feel for the big picture of this, and then we can zoom in and I can show how these are actually really well-defined model systems, and that's part of the reason we study them. So the big picture would be that each of these cylinders here would represent a protein or a group of proteins with from anywhere from several to a couple of hundred molecules bound into them. So light is absorbed here and it's moved between these proteins, and that's all they do is absorb light and move it, and finally into a protein which I won't talk about, which is called a reaction center, and there that's the readout step where you turn that excitation into separated charge, and then biochemistry happens after that on much slower time scales. So photosynthetic organisms do this because it's quite expensive biochemically to run these reaction centers. So you just want to keep them turning over all the time by capturing as many photons as you can and regulating the transfer of the energy into that reaction center. I'll give you a couple of specific examples because there's many different arrangements in nature. And this is part of the reason that makes it interesting to study. And already at this conference, you've seen a few talks talk about purple bacterial systems. These are the simplest systems because of their symmetry and because it's all happens in two dimensions. these picture of a particular purple bacteria. They live in strange places like in mud or shallow lakes, or they bloom in puddles until the puddle dries up. In any case, inside them are these membranes. Photosynthesis happens in membranes that support these proteins. And if you look at these membranes, and they've been imaged with atomic force microscopy, and this is a picture, though, from an artist, and you see all of these rings. And each ring here is a protein, and so it's our scaffold, and it houses a number of light-absorbing molecules. So the light could be absorbed in any of these small rings, the energy will make its way to the big ring and into the reaction center. So there's the layout. So if we zoom in on that same picture, it's at higher resolution, you see it looks really complicated, and that's mainly because of the protein scaffold. But if you strip away the protein, you can see over here the arrangement, the molecules. It still looks complicated because there's 36 molecules here that look like chlorophyll. Remember that each one is a two-level system, ground state and excited state. And then you have some carotenoids for photoprotection mainly. So this is the most well, I guess, communicated in talks picture of photosynthesis, this purple bacteria. Where the topic of my talk starts really is observation some time ago, a couple of years ago now, from the Fleming group at UC Berkeley, and they studied a little protein that comes from another kind of bacteria that lives in Octopus Spring in Yellowstone National Park. And this is a little linker protein that connects a light harvesting antenna to the reaction center. And they found with these colorful pictures, which I'll explain to you in the talk, that there was evidence here for electronic coherence between our two-level systems. But that in itself isn't so surprising. We often see electronic coherence in absorption spectra of molecules when they're interacting. The surprising thing was that the coherence was measured at 77K. That coherence after the excitation was in the system lasted for several hundred femtoseconds. So that's long enough for it to help this energy funneling process. And I'll explain that in this talk, but I'm going to talk about something else. It's a prokaryote, so it's not a bacteria. It's a eukaryote, not a bacterium. It's related to red algae. You see, this is red algae in here, but it's related because a few billion years ago, these organisms engulfed red algal cells and incorporated some of their DNA into them. And what that enabled them to do is to make use of this red pigment type, which is easily manipulated chemically, and you can make all sorts of colors with it. And so what they're able to do is adapt to their environment and construct quite unique antenna systems. So the antenna system is the arrangement of the two-level systems. So this is what they look like. These are microscope images superimposed with fluorescence. The fluorescence is a little leakage showing that the photosynthetic process is only 99% efficient. That's the 1% of chlorophyll emission that's not used to generate energy. They swim, they have flagella so that they can move and so on. But you see how much of that is red in the organisms, and most of them is this machinery that uses the light to give them energy and generate all their biomass. In fact, about half of the biomass on Earth generated in photosynthesis is generated by marine and freshwater algae, even though they only comprise themselves 1% of the photosynthetic biomass. They're very efficient. So now if we take one of these and slice it up and stain it and look under electron microscope, here's a cross-section here, you see that coffee bean shape, and zoomed in you see these dark lines here. This is a cross-section of those membranes I mentioned before that bind the photosynthetic protein. So in there is all of those big blobs I've been showing you so far. So there would be these green lines here. You see they come in pairs, and there's a space in between. In the membrane itself are the photosystems that I'm not talking about, where you power that electron transfer that in turn drives the biochemistry. What I'm talking about, and it's unique to cryptophytes, it's this arrangement of these red squares in the middle here. They're all stuffed into that space, and these are the light harvesting proteins. So what these are the ones that are just catching the light, moving it, and funneling it with 95% efficiency and more, depending on the organism or the species of this cryptophyte, into that membrane. And through the collaboration with Paul Comey's group, we know the high resolution crystal structures of these. Okay, so rather than a biological system being messy, it's actually a very precise structure. That protein is a rigid scaffold that really holds our two-level system's in place and also directs a lot of the optical properties. Now, turns out that we're fairly sure at this point that those proteins don't just float around in that space, but they come together in quite well-defined aggregates, and this is just four of them coming together. And when I strip away this protein, because this obscures everything, remember all it is a scaffold, you can see the light-absorbing molecules. So these, coming back to the start, these are the Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and so on. Each one can absorb light, a particular wavelength within the protein. So you have absorption at a range of energies in each protein. The energy is funneled down in energy, and at the same time it's funneled to the outside of the protein, to these thick colored molecules here, and then it will move between the proteins among those thick molecules. And you see that this particular arrangement, if you look at it hard enough, that it brings together these, to a close separation, these molecules colored here in the thick sticks, the lower energy ones, and that's the stepping stones for the energy as it moves between the proteins, between each protein's reaction center. Now, what's always puzzled us with this is that a bottleneck is how do you move across a protein. That's the biggest distance, it's 5 nanometers, and we could never justify in the excited state lifetime of 1 nanosecond how you could move far enough to actually get the excitation to a reaction center with the efficiency that we see. So the question is then, do each of these molecules behave as these independent two-level systems, or because of the electronic interactions between them, do they form more delocalized states? Is there electronic coherence, and if so, how can we measure that? And that's what I'll explain to you in the last 15 minutes of the talk. So this is the question. Now, talking to Andrew White this morning, I realized that my notation can be confusing here. What I mean here, these are product functions here where excitation would be on Alice, and Bob is in his ground state. This would be Bob and Alice in the ground state and excitation on Bob. So these are the two linear combinations of where I can put that excitation, not how I'm arranging spins. These are both singlet states. And so these eigenstates here would have the two different energies in the absorption spectrum, and these are the pictures that I'm going to be showing you that we measure in the experiment, that along the diagonal here we're going to see the energies of these states. These are the states that absorb light in spectroscopy. But I'm drawing it in this 2D axis system. This is what I'm going to have here. We're going to be plotting the states or the energies that I excite with my laser. We're going to be waiting some time, and then we're going to be looking at the energies that are radiated when we probe the system. So that can tell us just where energy moves to incoherently, but I'll show you also how we can look for signatures of this electronic coherence. Now, we don't just have the two states. We have more than that. We have 8 states here under that. This is the absorption spectrum of an isolated protein we've taken out of the organism, and it's in solution at room temperature. So there's 3 different chemical types of the molecule in this particular protein, and I've just color-coded the corresponding absorptions. What I mean here is that if you calculate the eigenstates of this whole 8 molecules or 8 two-level systems together, the coefficient, the wave function, is highest for the green molecules here at these two absorptions, and the blue ones on those lines, and so on. And we're going to simplify it further. This is our laser pulse spectrum. It's about a 25 femtosecond laser pulse, and you see it's covering just these 4 states. So we're going to look at them exclusively, simplify all of this. So remember, these are essentially the eigenstates of the vibrations and electronic states of the system, and they're loosely correlated with where excitation can be, except in the case in the center here, and the green molecules, which are close together and are strongly interacting, and these really are delocalized states. The excitation really is shared between the two molecules. It's those eigenstates I showed you before. On the other hand, the blue molecules absorbing here, they're 2.5 nanometers from the green pair, so they're weakly interacting. So, you can redraw the diagram. Before, I just had my eigenstates along the diagonal. Okay, they're eigenstates of the system, not of the entire system and bath. So we can have dynamics. I've also added some cross peaks here, just some of the cross peaks. What these cross peaks are is they're going to tell us about these electronic coherence, and I'll show you why. They can also tell us about dynamics. If I start excitation up here and there's some relaxation that takes it down in energy, so from here to here, that will show up as an exponentially growing in cross peak. You can just read off the excitation started here at this frequency and went down frequency to that frequency. In these experiments, it's called two-dimensional photon echo. So this information content is encoded in the echo measurement, and this is why we can do it. And I'm going to be talking about the cross peaks, though, and I want to focus on the contributions that come from electronic coherence, so I can give you some idea of that. So the experiment measures the coherence in this particular representation in the cross peak, so as follows. The excitation involves explicitly, in the signal direction we look at, explicitly two light-matter interactions to make the excited state. But in these systems where we have coupled molecules, you can imagine the case where that first light-matter interaction, say, over here, excites this eigenstate here, and the second one, the short laser pulse, covers all of these states, excites here. So what we end up with is a superposition state of alpha and beta, which is drawn like this. And then we wait some time before we read out what happens, and we keep varying that readout time. And then we see what happens, and the echo will radiate, and we measure the intensity. So because we have this superposition state, we're going to see it. There's an energy difference between those states, and it's introducing this phase factor in the measurement, and it will introduce an oscillation in the signal with a particular phase. The same for the other cross peak on the other side here. We're doing the opposite. We're starting exciting alpha and then beta, so we have the opposite superposition state. The sign of that energy difference is opposite, so those beats should be anti-correlated in this particular case. It works out to be nice and simple. So the experiment, which I can go through pretty rapidly, you'll appreciate that these are much harder to measure than what it will appear when I show Kathy's animation here. It's involving those three laser beams, as well as a fourth beam that lies on top of the signal, so we can measure the amplitude of the signal, not just the intensity, and that's important here. So I just want to give you a feel from the point of view is if you're in the lab here, what you'd actually be measuring using spectral interferometry here to measure these signals. And so you're going to see an interferogram up on this axis that's our CCD camera. And you're going to measure that for all these time steps between the first two pulses to give this tau axis. And ultimately, we'll Fourier transform that. So I've started out now. This is pulse 2, pulse 1, pulse 3. So pulse 2 and 1 are in the reverse order. That's negative time delay. And this is real data Kathy measured. And you saw we went from negative to zero delay. And then the other pulse moved back to give positive delay. And there's a whole series of spectral interferograms. We Fourier transform. And then you get the 2D spectrum. And then we would want to wait a little bit longer, let the dynamics happen longer, so we reset this, move our third pulse out, and do the same thing again. I love this animation. So, okay, so there was a day's work. And this is what we measure. If we Fourier transform that axis from minus tau to plus tau, we'll get the 2D spectra. I showed you some cartoons and of it before. Remember, all of this is on this protein, really complicated at room temperature. So there's all this line broadening. It takes a bit of time. We've studied it for a long time to identify our diagonal peaks and the cross peaks. They're the same as I showed you in the cartoon. I'll show you them again in a moment. if we just Fourier transform in positive tau, we get the so-called rephasing signal, which I showed you the diagrams for already. If we Fourier transform the negative tau, we get these non-rephasing diagrams. You see the data look different, and that's because we're actually mapping the Feynman diagrams differently in the second case compared to the first case. And this is, I'm going to show you, this is really useful for helping us believe what we've measured here. So to do that, I'm just going to focus on the cross peaks between these states where we had the delocalized excitation was over Alice and Bob. If you remember, the green molecules in the center of the protein. And I'm just going to look at these cross peaks. They're the cross peaks where I said we had that phase factor, omega alpha beta or omega beta alpha, in the exponential that would give oscillations. So if we look at the intensity of this as a function then of that waiting time along this axis, you'll see, firstly, you'll see that the signals are complicated. This intensity didn't show a simple oscillation. But in general, and this is reproducible, you can convince yourself that these are clearly anti-correlated intensities for this particular case. And that clearly, though, there's more than one frequency component. So it's not just the splitting between these states. And it turns out, fast-forwarding right to the end, I'm not really going to go into all of this because it gets more messy, but it's not just these two molecules that are coupled here. They're coupled, there's other molecules at least, that are on the edge of the protein as well as probably some of the red ones. So this is a coupled oscillator problem. You expect several frequencies here, and we can actually get out frequencies do correspond to all of these energy splittings. So if we just, from the analysis, take this energy splitting, so that's the main Fourier component, these oscillations, you do see that the upper and lower cross peak oscillations are anti-correlated like this, like we predicted. That alone may not convince you, so you can also look at the non-rephasing data measured separately. And now those same kinds of coherences I showed you that would give the oscillations during big T are appearing on the up diagonal, and they're actually much easier to measure in this case. So we can look at the intensity at these peaks here, which corresponds to the cross peaks I just told you. We can compare down here to the blue molecules, which are right on the edge of the protein. So here's the two coupled Alice and Bob delocalized states, and you see that's the frequency component, that's their energy splitting. You see this guy down here has that energy component in it, in its intensity, but it's a smaller amplitude. And you see vice versa when you look at the other splitting in these peaks. I just want to show you this one because I want to think about what the phase should be in these two data sets of these oscillations. This will help us understand I guess if this is real. And that is, so I showed you these cross peaks already, and we already worked out that these should be anti-correlated. So I've given the sign here of the dominant Feynman diagram that contributes to the signal that we've worked out. I won't go into the details of how you ascertain that. And I want to compare that to the phase of these related diagonal peaks, their oscillations. So it turns out that these two peaks should oscillate in phase because of the contributions to them, because this upper one here that's in the blue part mainly comes from an excited state absorption. And this is just all to do with what ways you can better interact with the photon, what molecules have the largest absorption coefficient, and we can work this out. So what happens here in that final readout step, instead of stimulating a signal, we actually absorb the probe. And so that has a minus sign, and that minus sign will flip the phase of this oscillation, just like in transient absorption. Okay, so that's why, in this case, the upper diagonal and the lower diagonal have the same phase, and that will be the same phase as the lower cross peak in the rephasing signal and opposite to the upper one. So you're probably terribly confused at this point, but what it means is that what we want to look at, if we compare these, this frequency component Well, these signals are just one of them should be out of phase, and that's this red one here. You see that? So these are all independently fit. We're not fixing the frequency, so there's some frequency difference in each of these data sets, which is, you can see by and large, this one is out of phase with the others. So that that supports the fact that this is supports the notion that this is real. And as I said, you can look at other cross peaks. These cross peaks are the best resolved ones because they're away from the diagonal. And these are the ones that actually tell us that this is the surprising thing, that those molecules that are 2.5 nanometers each from the center are also coupled into this problem. And the final thing here is how long that coherence lasts. You can see that we have these data here out to about 350 femtoseconds, and the coherence is strong over that whole time window. And this is all at room temperature, so this is temperature that this organism lives at, actually a little higher. So there's good evidence here that I can, the last minute I can talk about, the last slide here, that what's happening here is the electronic coherence feasibly couples these two lowest energy molecules, which are on the end of the protein, couples them together through the other molecules in the protein. That can allow us more efficiently to move through this bottleneck. So as we move the excitation through the proteins through action center, we no longer have the bottleneck. Now, why this bottleneck is, and it's specific to these organisms, is that these separations between the molecules here are about double that in most photosynthetic light harvesting proteins. Because you would think that the best way to make fast energy transfer is you make strong interactions, so let's just stuff as many molecules as we can into the space. And you can easily do that. And that's actually what green sulfur bacteria do, and they're the least efficient light harvesters. What you're better off doing is keeping the molecules far apart. This makes the system more photostable, and it reduces quenching of the excitation. but to do that, you have to have a very highly optimized system in order to keep your efficiency close to 100% of gathering that light and moving it. And it seems now that there's good evidence that this quantum coherence actually plays a role in assisting those dynamics. Yet there's open questions, of course. How do you have coherence for a few hundred femtoseconds when we're measuring this for any of the ground excited state coherences in this experiment? It's a photon echo experiment, and it's 20 femtoseconds. Okay, well, why is the superposition of these electronic states or the superposition of excitations at the sites, how can the coherence of those states last for hundreds of femtoseconds? This is an unanswered problem, and it may have something to do, one suggestion is, which I'll finish with here, is that the protein itself is a special fluctuating environment that gives you a kind of decoherence-free subspace, and that is by the protein itself is one molecule. It's not like a normal condensed phase system in chemistry where it's a liquid where all the molecules are doing their own thing, that if the fluctuations that give line broadening correlated, this may preserve the coherence, and that's a suggestion from a few workers at this point. So anyway, I'll finish on that note. Thank you.